Welcome to Nuclear Energy in Korea, a new podcast to promote discussion of major issues and challenges in U.S. and Korean nuclear energy. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. Well, I'm here with Dr. Charles Ferguson, the president of the Federation of American Scientists, and it's a great honor to be speaking with you this morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's great to do this first podcast.
Let's just jump right into it, if I may. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission assigned a task force to investigate the accident at Japan's Fukushima power plant. What did they discover about the plant there?
Well, what they discovered, and I should first say that they were operating on the basis of information, data, just in the first few months. And they realized that more information is going to come out in the next several months, even a few years. Because if we look back to the Three Mile Island accident in 1979 in Pennsylvania, it took a couple of years for a full assessment to be made. So with that in mind, with that caveat, this is really a preliminary assessment. So the task force report really looked at the ability of that nuclear plant to withstand two extraordinary natural disasters, a huge earthquake, and a tsunami crashing within an hour after the earthquake happened. And then they looked at the question of susceptibility to electrical outage, that there was what's called a common mode failure. That's some jargon by means of saying that, look, you know, if you lose electrical power to the plant, what can happen? Are there adequate safety features to keep the plant in a condition so there's not a release of radioactive materials? And if there is a release, can that be contained? Can that protect the public? So the task force also looked at emergency preparedness procedures, means of alerting the public, protecting the public, and also making sure that there are adequate regulatory measures in place, both in Japan, and what are the implications for the United States? Should the United States change its regulatory structure to account for the lessons learned from the Fukushima accident?
How many parallels can be drawn between the Fukushima plant and situations in the United States?
Well, actually, there are a lot of parallels because the Fukushima plant, the reactors used there, and there are a few types of what are called boiling water reactors. The very first one, Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1, was being built in 1970, and that was what's called a boiling water reactor Mark 1 design. And that originated in the United States. So if we look back to the 1950s, when the U.S. Navy was developing its first reactors for a submarine program, there are two types of designs they pursued, this boiling water reactor design and a pressurized water reactor design. And those two designs became the basis for the majority of commercial reactors being used in the United States, Japan, and also in the Republic of Korea, and as well as other countries. So with that in mind, there are a lot of parallels because the Fukushima plant's reactors were based on this U.S. design, and currently there are some 23 boiling water reactor Mark I, Mark II type designs operating in the United States. So that's over 20% of the U.S. reactors right now. So that's a substantial amount of the so-called fleet of U.S. design. So looking at what happened in Fukushima can be directly transferred to the U.S. When there are questions about the design and the functioning of the design of that plant itself. Now, where there are differences is in this extraordinary confluence of this massive earthquake and a massive tsunami. So it's likely in the United States, where we look at reactors that are near the coastline, say in California, it's likely that you wouldn't see a tsunami coinciding with a massive earthquake like we had seen in off the coast of Japan, because the type of earthquake fault system in the United States near the two nuclear plants in California aren't really susceptible to producing, you know, that kind of massive tidal wave like we saw in Japan, where it's a subduction type of earthquake fault.
Returning to the NRC task force report, did any of their findings come as a surprise?
Not particularly. I think there was a very thorough assessment based on the information they had, and it really tried to home in on questions of, you know, mitigation of the accident once it occurred, also trying to home in on how the plants could be better ventilated to prevent this buildup of hydrogen gas. And it was the hydrogen gas that exploded in reactors 1, 2, and 3 in Fukushima Daiichi, and also reactor unit 4 also experienced an explosion. And it's still a bit mysterious as to why reactor unit 4 experienced such an explosion, because reactor unit 4 wasn't operating right before the tsunami and earthquake hit. Only reactors 1, 2, and 3 were operating prior to the earthquake. And so there was a lot of decay heat, radioactive decay heat, that had to be removed from those three reactors. And so when there was a loss of coolant in those reactors, steam was formed, and that steam reacting with the cladding of the coolant produces hydrogen gas. As the hydrogen gas built up and it wasn't ventilated from the containment structure, any kind of spark would trigger that, and it could lead to an explosion, which happened in those reactors. And then that would open a conduit for the release of radioactive materials into the environment.
So what were some of the recommendations released by the task force?
Well, one of the first recommendations is to reevaluate and upgrade as appropriate what's called the design basis requirements for seismic earthquake, i.e. earthquake protection and flood protection of nuclear plants in the United States. And I should stop to say design basis means that a set of events that is expected to probably occur during the lifetime of a particular nuclear plant. And that's distinguished from what are called beyond design basis events, which are these station blackout, electrical blackout events where you lose all power from a plant. That's never really happened before. And especially prolonged station blackout in a nuclear plant. There have been cases where a plant may lose electricity for a relatively short period of time, but then external sources could be brought back to the plant, or you could deliver portable means of electrical power or start up emergency diesel generators. So following on that, the task force looked at this question of what can be done to try to prevent station blackout at plants, and if the blackout occurs, what can be done to mitigate the consequences if that leads to a loss of coolant in the plant, and that would mean, you know, the inability to take away this decay heat that builds up in a reactor over time. So that was really the first set of recommendations that they had, which didn't come as a surprise. They also recommended that the ventilation system of these type of boiling water reactors needed to be further hardened, and there needed to be means to ventilate the steam buildup and hydrogen buildup before it lead to an overpressurization or an explosion. They also looked at the question of emergency plans and how to communicate to the public more effectively in the event of a station blackout. And then finally, they looked at the question of how to strengthen licensing of the plants based on what's called the defense in depth concept.
What is defense in depth? I saw right. that term used a fair amount in the in the report, and it seemed to be quite significant. So.
It is, and I should say that it's very significant to me personally, because my experience in nuclear power begins when I was in the U.S. Nuclear Navy going back to the 1980s. And I went through the nuclear power school through the naval program, and it was drilled into us, the concept of defense in depth, a safety culture. Defense in depth sounds like a military term. It originates from the military, and it means that basically you have multiple means of protecting a nuclear plant. And if any protection fails, there are some multiple means to mitigate the consequences of an accident. And there are also multiple means to protect the public in the event of a release of radiation. So the question is, so what are these multiple means? And so if you look at the structure of a nuclear plant in terms of preventing the release of radioactive materials, there are anywhere 3, 4, or 5 different mechanisms prevent that release of radioactivity. At the very first level, when you have the nuclear fuel itself, there's a cladding material that's made of zirconium or some kind of metallic alloy that is designed not to rupture only in the event of severe, high temperatures or severe conditions. And if that ruptures, then the reactor pressure vessel itself is made out of very strong material to prevent rupture. And if that ruptures, there's a loss, say, loss of coolant, then there's a containment structure around the reactor pressure vessel. And that containment structure is typically made of reinforced concrete, very hardened materials. But that could also be breached. And if that's breached, then the set of mechanisms to mitigate the consequences have to be employed. And so what the task force looked at is defense in depth being adequately put in place at nuclear power plants? And they said, well, first you need to recognize that defense in depth has been a philosophy and not necessarily a set of license requirements. And so they looked at how that philosophy has developed over time, over the several decades of nuclear power plant use in the United States. They looked at the set of current regulations. They've looked at set of requirements. They've looked at guidelines that have developed after extraordinary events like the September 11th terrorist attacks or the concerns over truck bombings that happened in the 1990s, for instance. And what they realized was that from the perspective of the owners and operators of nuclear plants, things could look kind of inconsistent. So if you look at that whole system, they described it as a patchwork. So instead, what they were recommending was that attention needs to be placed on making sure there's consistency throughout all the guidance and information that's promulgated to licensees. But first and foremost, that defense in depth philosophy makes a lot of sense. There's a logical consistency to it, and they emphasize that should be further integrated within all the regulatory requirements.
Is any of their investigation questioning the depth to which the defense actually reaches and maybe thinking about additional ways to bolster that? Or is it really just trying to streamline the existing defenses in place?
The way I read it, I think it's both. I think they want to, we go back to specific recommendations they had in light of the Fukushima accident, especially dealing with station blackout, loss of electrical power. It's clear that what happened in Fukushima was a loss of defense in depth, because too many aspects of the safety systems, too much of the equipment, the valves and the pumps, depended on that ability to have electrical power. And so instead, it would have been great to have manual operation, ability to open vents quickly to prevent the buildup of this overpressurization of steam and then the hydrogen buildup. So that indicated that defense in depth was not working properly at Fukushima, and that might happen at some of the U.S. nuclear plants of that design. So yes, in that first category, that's right. You need to look at whether defense in depth is really truly there of every single nuclear plant operating in the U.S. And then it's also true that it's a matter of streamlining regulations, making sure there's a consistency in the regulatory process, and that design philosophy of defense in depth is included throughout that process.
In terms of the task force recommendations, is there any way for the U.S. to prioritize what it addresses first and how to accommodate those new recommendations by the task force?
Yes, I think so. And I think it has to go multifold. I mean, in terms of prioritization, I think the criteria that makes sense to me is first look at those older plants that have that boiling water reactor Mark I, Mark II type designs. And as I said earlier, there are about 20-some of those types of plants. So those should be higher up on the list. And then the next criterion I think makes sense is look at, in terms of geography, the vulnerability to severe earthquakes, the vulnerability to an earthquake coupled with severe flooding, or this vulnerability to tornadoes or some kind of extraordinary natural event that could severely tax the plant and lead to loss of electrical power.
So I'd like to return to the concept of defense in depth. How prominent a role has it played in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's philosophy over time?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it has played a fairly significant role. And I think even going back to the 1970s, when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself was being formed, and I think this is also an important lesson learned looking at what happened in Japan, and it's also an important lesson for Republic of Korea, and it's the role of the regulatory agency itself. Let's look at briefly at the history of the U.S. regulatory system, how it developed. Going back to the 1950s, the very start of nuclear power in the United States, there was what was called the Atomic Energy Commission, and it had a dual role. It had the regulatory oversight role, and it had the role of promoting nuclear power. And, it could lead to conflicts of interest. So it was recognized for a long time that those two roles need to be separated. And by the time we got to the early 1970s, there was finally a requirement from U.S. Congress to form two separate agencies out of the Atomic Energy Commission. There was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission being formed, and its primary role, in fact, really its sole role, was about safety, making sure that it provided that strong, independent oversight. And it's important to really think about what does strong and independent mean. Strong means that it has enough authority to overrule industry. And independent means it has it's independent from other government agencies, that the Department of Energy or Department of State can't come in and saying, oh, no, don't order the shutdown of this plant because, you know, we need it to keep it operating for whatever reason. And then the other agency that was formed was called the Energy Research Development Agency, acronym ERDA, and that eventually became the Department of Energy. And that had more of the promotional role of trying to encourage further use of nuclear energy, providing funding for research and development of further nuclear energy and other energy systems.
The Blue Ribbon Commission also recently published a report on nuclear waste management in the United States. In general, was the prognosis a positive one?
Yes, I think it was. And I got to admit, when the Blue Ribbon Commission was announced a couple of years ago, I and some other people in the field who were independent analysts said, what, really? Do we need another commission to analyze nuclear waste disposal options in the United States? And this seemed to be, to many people, kind of a political construct, because Senator Harry Reid was then the Senate Majority Leader, he still is, he's from Nevada, and there was a huge controversy over the Yucca Mountain Project in Nevada, and that was designated to store U.S. spent fuel from commercial purposes as well as some military purposes. And the citizens of Nevada said, well, look, you know, we've never benefited directly from commercial nuclear energy. We don't have nuclear power plants in our state. Why do we have to take on the role, this burden of taking the nation's nuclear waste? So how this came about
was a very good question.
You know, came about through, you know, politics and going back to the late 1980s when the law was changed so that Yucca Mountain was designated as the only site to be considered. Prior to that, there were two or three other sites that were being looked at, and one was in Texas. And so the congressional delegation from Nevada in the late 1980s was relatively weak. And, just to be blunt about it, just really looked like senators and congressmen from other states just pushed through new legislation saying, Nevada, well, you know, you're going to be it. You're going to be the state that takes this waste.
So it was more about political brawn than it was about actually investigating the suitability of these different locations.
Absolutely. And so, that's really in contrast to what's happened in Sweden. Sweden is a great example of how it was done correctly, where you had three different sites that were being looked at. And the public was involved early on, and all three sites were looked at equally. And the local constituencies of those locations saw, oh, this could be a good jobs program. As long as the facility could be run safely, and they saw that, this could actually be something that communities would want to compete for, and they would want to have a nuclear waste repository in that location. And in fact, the United States, there's an example in New Mexico, what's called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, the WIP facility. And it's accepted certain types of waste from military activities, other kind of activities, but not commercial spent fuel. And the community nearby really, as far as I understand, really likes that program. It's a good jobs program. And the geology of that site is well suited to keeping nuclear waste isolated. It's a salt formation, and salt over time, and actually relatively quickly, kind of envelops that waste and keeps it stationary. So there are concerns also raised about the technical suitability of the Yucca Mountain site. So so let's fast forward to the presidential election in 2008. We had Barack Obama, then Senator Obama, who was became the leading contender on the Democratic side. And he was aligned, obviously, with Senator Reid, also a Democrat. And so they struck a deal. And so President Obama, who is actually quite pro-nuclear power, also realized that politically he needed Senator Reid's support. So they formed a deal saying once Obama got elected, they would take a fresh look at this issue. They would put the Yucca Mountain Project on hold. In fact, they've actually acted to shut it down. So to all extents and purposes, Yucca Mountain is kind of at best on life support. And so to buy some additional time to take a new look at this, they formed this Blue Ribbon Commission that began in early 2010. And it's a very good group of people. I would say a very good group of people. They have a lot of experts on the technical side, and they have experts on the political side. It's being chaired by, on the Republican side, General Brent Scowcroft, and on the Democratic side, former Congressman Lee Hamilton. Two very well-respected people. And they just came out with their draft recommendations this summer, and we're now nearing the end here in late October, the end of the public comment period. And so in early December, there's going to be another public meeting in Washington, D.C. with the Blue Ribbon Commission. They're going to show their current findings and current recommendations based on the public comment period. And they said, obviously, there's the need for a place for safe and secure storage of nuclear waste and spent nuclear fuel from the commercial sector in the United States. And they support what's called a geologic repository. And they didn't specifically mention Yucca Mountain, but a place where you can keep that waste contained for a long period of time. Probably 10,000 years or longer, and you need, once again, kind of defense in depth type of mechanisms. You need multiple barriers to prevent that radioactive materials from entering in the water supply or the food supply.
So but those would have to be developed after they've already identified the location, because it seems like the defenses would have to be tailored to that location.
Absolutely, and so that raises a very important point. That's going to take some time. It may take decades to really have those kinds of assurances and develop those means for the specific location they identify. And you also need to look at not just one location, but two or three or more locations. And it may have to be regional repositories, so it's burden sharing throughout the United States. Meanwhile, what do we do? So one thing they recommend is that we need interim spent fuel storage. Fortunately, there are technical ways of doing that. There are what are called dry storage casks, where we can place spent fuel into these casks for a relatively long period of time. It's believed, based on technical assessments, that these casks could last for at least 100 years.
But not 10,000.
But not 10,000, okay. Exactly. Okay. So we can't procrastinate. Okay. That's a very important point. It'll buy time for the United States. And we shouldn't dilly-dally. We should move ahead with evaluating the longer term, the more permanent repository locations. while we can place that spent fuel in these dry storage casks. And they can be placed in the cask after 5 years of cooling at the and spent fuel pools at the reactor sites.
Well, it sounds like, you know, not only is the cost in terms of resources incredibly high, but in terms of time.
Yes.
I mean, it's going to take a long time for each site. So to what extent does the U.S. have to incorporate its anticipations of where nuclear energy mm-hmm. will be in decades? And how is that going to weigh into the process of identifying these yeah. sites?
Well, and we've already reached the congressional limit, almost reached the congressional limit for the current Yucca Mountain site, even if that were still really viable. Congress some time ago said there's only about 70,000 or so tons of spent fuel that could be placed in Yucca Mountain, although technical studies say it might be much more than that, might be two or three times that limit. Nonetheless, we're already at a point in the United States where we're already butting up against that limit. So we're going to need more than one permanent repository because nuclear power is going to be continue to be used in the United States for some decades to come, even with the current existing fleet of about 104 reactors. And there may be more reactors being built. And so we have to take that into account as well.
So how has the Obama administration supported the development of nuclear energy in the U.S.? And has it done enough?
Well, despite coming from some criticism, especially during the presidential campaign, when there was a debate early on between Senator McCain and Republican side and then Senator Obama. And at one point in one of the debates, Senator McCain pointed to Senator Obama and said, you know, that one doesn't like reprocessing. So that's been a controversial issue. Reprocessing means taking spent nuclear fuel and extracting the plutonium in that fuel and recycling it into fresh fuel. And so that could be a means to reuse that material.
Could it also diminish the waste?
And also diminish the volume of the waste, mm-hmm. but not necessarily the requirement to have a repository of a certain size, because the repository size really depends on the amount of heat given off from that waste. So plutonium is a relatively low radioactive material. The high radioactivity comes from what are called fission products, radioactive cesium, radioactive strontium, those kind of materials. And those things are going to remain very radioactive and give off a lot of heat for at least 200, 300 years after removal from a reactor. Mm-hmm. So reprocessing won't really save as much in terms of the size of the repository, but it can shrink the volume of the waste that needs to be stored longer term. And thinking about the recommendations that come out of the Blue Ribbon Commission, one of the very interesting set of recommendations is about the development of proliferation-resistant and other means to reduce the amount of waste that needs to be stored. You know, could we burn up the plutonium and uranium coming that are in spent fuel, as well as the other fissionable materials like curium and americium and neptunium, all those kinds of elements that a lot of people don't even think about, probably never even heard about, but these are things that will last for a long period of time. So if we can develop mechanisms to fission them in special types of reactors or using other types of technologies, we could further reduce that waste burden. So the Blue Ribbon Commission said, well, let's go ahead and recommend research, development, and demonstration of those kinds of technologies. And what's also interesting from the standpoint of countries like Japan and Korea is that the Blue Ribbon Commission strongly emphasized an international approach. There should be international cooperation in research and development and finding other mechanisms to deal with the nuclear waste disposal problem. So getting back to the Obama administration, the one real controversy between President Obama and Republicans has been on this question of what to do with nuclear waste. But let's put that aside for the moment. The Obama administration and the vast majority of Republicans support nuclear power. And in 2005, you know, when President Obama was just getting into the Senate, and you know, long before he was president, a law was passed called the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and it offered various incentives for nuclear power. There were federal loan guarantees. There were tax credits for new nuclear plants as well as renewable energy sources. There was what's called regulatory risk insurance to help streamline that regulatory process. And if it got delayed, that nuclear operators who are trying to develop new plants could get assistance from the Department of Energy to help deal with the regulatory issues. And there was also a controversial provision to extend the liability coverage of nuclear plants, what's called the Price-Anderson Act. So that was kind of the package that was available in 2005. And President Obama and his team, and Secretary of Energy Steve Chu and his team, they're supportive of that. And in fact, it was Secretary Chu, when he came in early 2009, he looked around and said, well, gee, we've had this provision for almost 4 years for these loan guarantees, and they've been stuck. The Bush administration wasn't able to push them through. And so Secretary Chu said it's one of his priorities to get these federal loan guarantees moving. And so they've went ahead and issued a loan guarantee for a nuclear power plant being built in Georgia at the Vogtle nuclear power plant site. You know, that's had some controversy attached to it, but it seems to be moving forward. So that seems to be a good decision. Where there's controversy is on issuing loan guarantees for another project in Ohio. There is a uranium enrichment facility being built by the United States Enrichment Corporation called the American Centrifuge Project, and it's very risky, both technically and financially. And a lot of money has been poured into that facility, and they have a demonstration plant. But to scale it up to a commercial facility, they're requesting another $2 billion of federal support, one of these loan guarantees. And this comes right at the time of a controversy over a solar energy plant, Solyndra. So the Obama administration has come under a lot of fire from the Republican side for a $500 million loss for supporting this solar energy company, Solyndra. Meanwhile, Congressman Boehner, who is a Republican leader in the House, says we shouldn't pick winners and losers in terms of energy companies. And then shortly after that, he says, but the President of the United States, President Obama, should carry through his commitment to the people of Ohio to support the facility being built, this centrifuge facility being built in Ohio. So we see this political controversy over these billions of dollars worth of federal loans. Is that a smart approach or not? And so there are those who are saying, should we instead rely on more neutral market mechanisms instead of saying, well, this company should get this favorable treatment, this company should not. Instead, should it be more of a market approach where you send a price signal? If you can put a tax on carbon emissions, for instance, or some kind of fee on carbon emissions, because no tax is a word people don't like, you can structure it so that you send the right market signal that would favor nuclear power as well as development of other greener energies like wind and solar. So that's another controversial area that the Obama administration has, by and large, been supportive of these federal loan guarantees. Now they're in the process of reevaluating them in light of some losses, especially in the solar energy area. And within the next few days, in early November, there's a deadline for a decision on $2 billion worth of loan guarantees for this nuclear plant in Ohio.
It's pretty clear that politics, will inevitably play into these policy decisions and very important decisions about the future of nuclear energy in the U.S. How nervous are you about an election next year, and how susceptible can this research and these plans be to political tides?
Very susceptible, and that's one of the problems with U.S. energy policy in general. We've seen that over the last 40-some years. Go back to the Nixon administration. Every president since President Nixon has said, U.S. is addicted to oil, we need an energy policy, and every president has failed to really carry it through. There's been all sorts of issues from economics to regional politics, opposition or favoritism within Congress. We could spend the next few hours talking about all this. But kind of summing up, it's unfortunate that we don't have that longer term vision and support for energies like nuclear energy or wind and solar that can help the United States transition to a lower carbon economy. And that's the future direction that I believe we need to head in. And the question is, so what are the right economic and policy tools to make that happen? And one of the big barriers for nuclear power is that these plants are very expensive to build. For a large 1,000 megawatt electric nuclear power plant in the United States, these plants could cost anywhere from $5, $6 billion or higher, maybe $9 billion, depending on the financial risk attached to the project. So if these plants could literally be built overnight, which they can, it's a fantasy, but what's called overnight costs are high, but not that terribly high. They're still relatively cost competitive with coal or even some natural gas projects. Natural gas is a different issue. Let me get to that in a moment. But in terms of competitiveness with coal, if even putting aside fees on carbon emissions, nuclear could be competitive with coal if I think nuclear had the means of support, a long-term support. If somehow we can amortize the price of a nuclear plant over its 40 to 60 year lifespan, like we amortize a mortgage on a home, then, and if there's enough means of collateral support that a company had, a lot of ifs here, but it could allow investors the confidence that once they get over the hurdle of paying for those upfront costs in building a nuclear plant, that once the plant is safely operated, these things could become cash cows and they can actually be a good return on investment. But it's really getting through that crucial period, up to almost 10-year period, from the time of thinking about constructing the plant, to getting it licensed, to getting the money needed to start building it, to the several years to actually build the plant. There's so much uncertainty every single stage of that process. It tends to drive up the cost.
I was glad to hear you mention Korea a few minutes ago. I would like to turn to Korea for just a moment. Since the Fukushima nuclear accident, at a time when a lot of countries were thinking maybe of curtailing some of their reliance on nuclear energy, South Korea has stepped forward and has demonstrated its interest in being a leader in nuclear energy technologies. Yeah. What lessons can the United States learn from the Korean experience of building nuclear power plants?
Well, the Korean model is first to cultivate close relationships and partnerships with clients and potential clients. It's a fundamental principle of how to do business that it seems maybe the U.S. has kind of lost sight of this fundamental principle. And maybe it's just the Korean culture and the geopolitical environment they live in that they realize that it can take years to develop those kinds of relationships. So it's a matter of getting the experts from the other countries to talk with Korean experts, to have seminars, to have meetings, to just have a dialogue. So that's where it starts. And then the other important principle is to make sure that both cost and safety have high priority importance, equal importance. So it's a matter of balancing those two. So safety shouldn't be shortchanged. But on the other hand, you don't want to load up safety so much that if you drive up the cost of the plant, then it's not competitive compared to the other companies or other countries in terms of their plants that they're offering for sale. A great example of this, just to be concrete, is the deal between the United Arab Emirates and the Republic of Korea. That is really just a great example of this Korean model of first cultivating the relationship, having the kind of dialogue months or at least a few years in advance, and then having very high-level attention to the very top. So President Lee Myung-bak, he traveled to the UAE, he met with their leadership, and so the signal was very clear that this is a very high priority for Korea. France was one of the lead competitors for a while. There was also high-level attention from France. President Sarkozy had traveled to the UAE, and he was helping cultivate that relationship. But the French nuclear plant is being offered what's called the EPR, the European Pressurized Reactor, Evolutionary Pressurized Reactor, was deemed to be too expensive. And the United Arab Emirates, they saw a great example of why it was too expensive. In Finland, the first EPR is being built. It's well over budget. It's at least a couple of billion dollars over budget, if not more. And it's delayed by at least a few years, if not longer. And even in France, the home of the EPR, where they're building second EPR in Flamanville, they've also run into delays in terms of construction and also cost overruns. So in comparison, in Republic of Korea, the recent nuclear plants have been built on time and within budget. That sent a clear signal to the Emirates that the Korean model offered the close relationships, the partnerships. It offered reasonable cost and still very good safety.
My understanding is that this relationship between the UAE and South Korea actually goes deeper than just these high-level discussions, to the point where there's actually educational exchange occurring between the two countries, where you're actually ferrying students from one country to the other to be educated in nuclear energy technology. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's right. And that's really about thinking about this as a real partnership. It's not just thinking about this as Korea as a vendor, just providing some technologies.
With a price tag.
Yeah. Exactly. Because the Emirates, having been there once, I know that they outsource a lot of their industries because they have a relatively small indigenous population. And so there's a tension here because all the nuclear power countries, they've had to develop their indigenous capability to regulate the plants and to operate the plants. And so that's been a core responsibility of a national government. And so the Emirates felt like they were in a bind. They said, well, we want nuclear power and we can make a strong case for it. And we have the money to pay for it, but we don't have the people. And so the Korean experts said, don't worry, we could work with you and we could train your people and help you build up that capacity.
Well, Dr. Ferguson, this has been enlightening and a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, Martha, and I enjoy the conversation, and hopefully the listeners will have learned something.